Hey, this is David from MyNAMS and the Novice to Advanced Marketing System. This is the Insiders monthly micro workshop that we do. And this today is a very special one to me because I'm a systems guy. I've always been a systems guy. I have an ideal in my life that anything that can be automated would be automated. Anything that can be efficient is more efficient. And I fail at that more than I succeed, but to have that as a goal is always a good thing, I think, in business. And so when Will Matos and I got together in July last year in Las Vegas, we had system conversations, and I was fascinated by what Will was doing as the co-founder of Rapid Crush and as kind of the operations brains behind Rapid Crush. Will is kind enough to share with us a lot of the work that they're doing and what they've done to basically grow their business in 3 years. What are you doing now, Will? About 9 million in 3 years?
We did over 9 million in 3 years. We finished last year alone as a $4.2 million company.
Not bad for a three-year-old company, right? So your systems are really driving a lot of your revenue and a lot of your success. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. All about the system.
So, Will, the way we do this is we have a little six-step process that we use called Dream, Prototype, Test, Execute, Feedback, and Improve. Then we always bring our instructor in. The instructor, we pump that guy for as much information as we can in the beginning. And then in the afternoon, that's part one, by the way, where we do the pumping. Part two, Will will not join us in part two. In part two, we will actually do some implementation on what we've discovered in the first session, and we'll also look at some other areas that we may not get to. There's a lot when you talk about business operations that have to be covered. Some of that is insurance. Some of that is the type of business structure that you have. And so we're going to get into that in the afternoon quite a bit and help you guys create a structural plan for your business that will be sustainable. Now, Will, if you don't mind, tell folks how you got started in this world of business online and what your background is a little bit.
David, all right, I'll try and keep this short, but I actually have a story that's different than almost everybody else I've ever met in the internet marketing industry. I actually got into this because I love my job so much. and that sounds very strange, so let me explain a little bit. I, from a very young age, had a goal of climbing the corporate ladder and being a CIO at an early age. Mm-hmm. And I was well on my way to achieving that because I was a director of IT for a multinational organization at the age of 29. I was so stressed out in that job that I decided one day to just step off the ladder and took a nice, very easy job as a systems engineer for a software company in the pre-sales division. And I loved that job so much that it got me into internet marketing. And the reason I loved it was because of the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I was working from home. I set my own hours. I'd wake up whenever I want to. I'd work the hours that I wanted. I was just talking to clients on the phone. I set my own appointments. And you know, worked with the latest and greatest technology and worked with amazingly brilliant people. And so one day I was there thinking, man, I really, really love this job. I'm making almost 200 grand a year. I mean, life is just absolutely awesome. Mm-hmm. And then I remembered, you know, in this very company that I've been working in, I've survived five or six layoffs throughout my history. Mm-hmm. And I remembered that at the end of the day, I was just a number. No matter how well I did my job, I was just a number. And I told myself, I want to perpetuate this situation. I don't ever want to punch a clock again. I don't ever want to have to go to an office every single day. And what is it that I can do to perpetuate this lifestyle that I already have? And so I started learning how to, you know, what I could do online and did a lot of research like everybody else does. Fumbled for a couple of years before I had any success, but persevered and worked on building systems and met Jason, formed an amazing partnership, and here we are.
So when you say you fumbled, a lot of people get discouraged in the fumble part, and we all fumble. You know, I think it was 2 years before I made my first nickel, and I probably spent like $50,000 doing all the research and the building. Talk about the fumble a little bit.
Yeah, basically what you said. You know, I made some okay money you know, $500 a year, $1,000 there, and, you know, pretty quick because I got into a nice little niche. I set up a website promoting credit card offers, and I went down the path of promoting 0% interest credit cards. So it was very easy to promote that, hey, you know, if you have credit card debt, do a balance transfer. So the marketing angle was very easy, and it was at the time that the market was really good. All you had to do was breathe to get credit. So everybody who applied got credit, and I got paid a commission. Mm-hmm. That quickly went away. But I knew that that wasn't real income, you know, to sustain my lifestyle for me to be able to quit my job or survive if my job went away. So I started looking at other things and started buying courses and going to conferences and trying new niches and trying new methods and chasing that proverbial bright, shiny object like everybody else.
Yep.
And I did that for 2 years. And like you, I spent tens of thousands of dollars. But there was one thing that I realized after those couple of years is that I was doing what a lot of people do now, is I wasn't really putting in the effort. I kept looking for that magic button like everybody else mm-hmm. does. You know, I kept looking for that one thing that was going to be so easy that it was just going to, you know, I'd buy the system, I spend a few hours on it, and it was going to be great because that's what they sold me on the sales letter, right?
Right.
And so I went from one thing to the next, jumped from one thing to the next to the next. What really changed my view on things was going to a conference, and actually the same conference that you and I attended in July, the Earn 1K a Day conference. It was the first event, I believe it was in 2009. And I went to that event and met some really bright people, and they a couple of them slapped me around a little bit, you know, virtually slapped me around and you know, said, what are you doing? You're wasting your time here. You know, I had some software that I had built, but I had it in my mind because I worked in the software industry that I never wanted to sell software.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they said, what are you thinking? This is your strength. You've got to do this. And I did it. I came back from the conference, and a few weeks later, I did it. Made my first sell of my first product. And honestly, the rest is history, because I'll tell you, when I started making sales, David, while I was asleep, that was the best feeling ever.
Yeah, you get addicted to that.
It's really cool to sit in front of your computer and see the money coming in and see your PayPal balance increase. I tell you, it's really cool.
Yep.
But it's even cooler to wake up and go check your stats and see that you made all this money while you were asleep. Mm-hmm. Or you made all this money while you were at dinner with your family. Or you made all this money while you were out, you know, at the gym or doing something that you love that's not working. That's when it really hits you how awesome this is and how awesome it is to have a real business.
So you said real business. Now, you and I said before this started that there's a big difference between making a lot of money and having a real business. And we talked about some examples that are out there right now where there are fads and everybody's jumping on the T-shirts online and all this other kind of stuff. Talk about that difference a little bit, the difference between real business and making a lot of money.
Yeah. So I've been teaching this to our coaching students for over 2 years now. You know, everybody wants to make money online. So I start my training sessions with, like, you know, who here wants to make money online? And, you know, everybody raises their hand, either virtually or physically, right? So, yeah, I want to make money online. And I say, it's a trick question. You shouldn't want to make money online because it's short-lived. What you should do is you should want to build a business. And a business is an entity that is self-sustaining and has real assets, that is not based upon one technique to, you know, make a lot of money, right? Or make you a little bit of money. Like the T-shirt thing you're talking about. Yeah, everybody here has probably heard about the T-shirt stuff. Is it hot? Are people making a lot of money? Yes, they are. But what happens if that one company that they're all using ends up going out of business, ends up breaking, or, you know, there's a time of year where there are no sports going on and they can't sell more T-shirts at that point, or, you know, a real business doesn't have ups and downs that are extreme, where today you're making $20,000 and then next month you're making zero and you're having to figure out a brand new tactic to make money. A business, a real business, should have a sustainable growth plan. And that's how I look at it. So you build assets that are valuable that you can leverage regardless of, you know, a Google Slap, or regardless of your one provider going out of business, or your PayPal account being shut down, or, you know, whatever one thing that happens is not going to break you. And it's going to allow you to continue to grow, continue to survive, continue to bring in that net revenue.
Yeah, so I love the idea of real business. I've been preaching that a long time as well. In fact, the track that we have, that is the 400 track at the NAMS workshop, is all about building a sustainable business, because we find that people make money, they make a lot of money, but they get there and they're working their fanny off, always trying to do something new instead of having something that they could actually hand off and sell if they wanted to. I told you about a response that I got online the other day when I was sick, and somebody said, "Oh, David, the NAMS workshop is coming up, and it can't be Davidless." Well, the truth is, if it can't be Davidless, I haven't been successful, because that's my goal, is that I can be as little involved as possible and be the person who helps build the umbrella or the strategy for the entire business. And to me, you got to start with that kind of a strategy. Is that what you did?
Yeah, so, you know, to touch on that subject of the example of NAMS being Davidless, NAMS could take a hit if you aren't around. From a customer perception point of view, but not from an operational point of view. And that there's a difference there, right? So what you want to strive for, first of all, is to make sure that NAMS can be Davidless from an operations perspective. Your employees are taken care of, your customers are taken care of, your products are being delivered on schedule. Your marketing may hurt if you're not around for a bit, but if everything else is taken care of, if the business is sustainable, is sustaining itself because of all the other systems that you have in place, then the business can recover from David not being around anymore. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, you're in a partnership with Jason Fladlin. Jason, and you guys, it's one of the best partnerships I've ever seen, because you are so focused on the operations of the business and Jason is so focused on the marketing part of the business, and you guys fit like hand in glove with each other. So if something happened to one or the other of you, what happens to the business?
Yeah, so part of building a business is thinking about business continuity, right? A business should be a living entity as we see it. And we have plans in place at Rapid Crush to handle any eventuality or anything that comes up. So, for example, should something happen to Jason and he's not around anymore, we have an insurance policy on him. And same thing for me. So although the business would take a hit for a certain amount of time, the business can survive without us having to, you know, basically quit and start over, right? Mm-hmm. Would it be difficult to replace Jason? Will it be difficult to replace me? Yeah, probably. We might have to be replaced by two or three or four people, and that's totally fine because the business can do it. We have those contingencies in place. And there's more to it than just the business itself. We also have to think about our families, right? And that's what I think about a business when we talk about a real business. Is there something that I can leave to my children? Will they have value of whatever I leave for them? Because if I'm doing a t-shirt strategy and running some Facebook ads and I'm making a lot of money, if I stop those ads and if I go away and they don't know how to run those ads, right, will they have something to survive with? And the answer is no to that, right?
Right.
But if I have systems in place where the business can run itself, even if it takes a little bit of a hit because, hey, the face of the company, Jason, might not be around anymore, I can go hire somebody else to replace him and pay them whatever amount of money is necessary, or two people or three people, and within a relatively short period of time, maybe a few months, we can be back to where we were before.
So
one of our business continuity plans, mm-hmm, is what we call cross cross-sell insurance. So he's insured, I'm insured. And we also have some key players in our organization that are employees that we consider key players, and we have our key man policies on them as well, meaning if something happens to them, we have the funds to go hire the best and the brightest to replace them and be up and running very quickly.
So I want to talk about the key man policy there for a second, because some people would think, well, you know, is this an insurance policy that is big enough that you could shut the business down and everybody's fine? Or is it an insurance policy that gives you breathing room until you can work out whatever kinks need to be worked out?
Yeah, so the idea, David, it has to, a lot of it has to do with mindset as well, right? So This insurance policy that we have certainly is big enough where we could shut down the business and be done with it, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd walk away sitting pretty, right? The other party would. And the way that it works is, in our case, is this. It goes hand in hand with what we call a buy-sell agreement. And a buy-sell agreement is part of our partnership documentation, is part of the corporation documents that state everything that is going to happen, that can happen, that will dissolve this partnership. Whether it's one of us dying, whether it's one of us getting divorced, whether it's, you know, we get upset at each other and we want to just break up this partnership, whether it's one of us wants to step out of the business and sell it. Pretty much anything that you could think of that would end up changing the business structure is defined in this buy-sell agreement. So this buy-sell agreement, for example, defines that should we need to cash in on each other's life insurance policy, a certain percentage of those funds has been agreed ahead of time that it will be used to buy out the other person's shares. So Jason is, you know, likes to be my partner, right? And I like to work with Jason, but I would not want to work with Jason's significant other should he pass away.
Right.
She would inherit his shares in the business, right?
Right.
So I don't want to work with her. I don't know her. I don't, you know, she may not be a good partner for me, right? So I am actually forced in our buy-sell agreement to buy her out, and she is forced to sell to me at a specified price, which is 50% of the life insurance policy. The other 50% is mine. Mm-hmm. I can do whatever I want with it. I could just shut down the business and go away, and like I said, I'd be happy. But that is not the mindset that we have, David, and I think that mindset is important as you build the businesses and as you manage the business. The goal of that money is to maintain the business. It's to keep paying employees. It's to go out and hire new talent. It's to keep taking care of the customers, right? Mm-hmm. So could I go shut down the business and walk away with, you know, my millions of dollars? Yes, I could. But that isn't what I would do, and that isn't what Jason would do. We both believe in this and continuing to grow the business and the assets that we have, because whatever money we may walk away with is peanuts compared to what we're actually trying to build.
Sure.
So, long answer to your question, but the bottom line is, our cross-sell policy is half is going to buy the other person's shares, mm-hmm. and the other half is to get the business back to where it needs to be while being able to maintain all the employees and you know, continue to run the business, even if there's a significant reduction in revenue.
So this is really interesting. Nobody ever talks about this kind of stuff, Will. I think it's really important because when you get your – my feeling is that this is not something that you started with but probably evolved over time. Is that correct?
Well, I'll be honest. No, we started with it, and it's not something that I came up with. We actually are very fortunate to have a very good team of advisors. Mm-hmm. And our team of advisors are comprised of a very good CPA, a very good financial advisor, and a very good attorney. So we started with a CPA who helped us form the corporation, and he put us in touch with a financial advisor. And the financial advisor actually helped us set up the business structure and advised us on the buy-sell agreement. And then in conjunction with the lawyer who drafted it, we went through the entire process of agreeing on all the terms and so forth. So no, I didn't come up with it. I had some significant assistance and guidance. And this is what I definitely recommend to anybody is you need a good team of advisors. You've got to start with a CPA very quickly enlist a financial advisor who, and either of those two people can put you in touch with an attorney if you don't have one.
Yep.
The type of attorney that you want to start with is a contracts person, somebody who specializes in contracts, because a lot of what you use a lawyer for is contract-based stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not litigation.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's contracts. So somebody who specializes in contracts is the right person.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you a question you may not want to answer, but I know that in the beginning you and Jason plopped in some money together, and it wasn't a lot. So from the very beginning, you guys had an idea of what this business was going to be, and it was a lot bigger than what you started with.
Yeah, so I'll answer that. We started the way Jason and I met at a conference. We attended a mastermind event that also happened to coincide with Earn & K-Day. So you know the reason I like Earn & K-Day so much, and I always go to it.
Yep.
Is because it's brought me a lot of very fortunate experiences along the way. So I met Jason when I went to Earn & K-Day event back in 2010, I believe. And we, in conversations in the mastermind, we came up with this product idea, which even to date was one of the best products we've put out, one of the most profitable products we've put out, which is called WP Twin, our WordPress cloner.
Sure.
And that was just a joint venture between our companies. You know, I developed it, he marketed it, and it just turned out to be so amazing working together that right after that project, we launched that product in October. By December, we knew we wanted to work together. So by the end of December of 2010, we filed the incorporation papers so that we could start working together in January of 2011. We started the business with a $5,000 investment each. And the only reason we did that much is because we needed to pay for all of the attorney's fees and, you know, the incorporation papers and all of that. But that is the only money we've ever pumped into that business, and we actually got that money out by March. We didn't start selling anything until March. It took us a couple months to set up the infrastructure. We made a few sales here and there in January and March, but we really, really cranked the business up in March of 2011.
Okay, so let me back up here for a second, too, because I'm trying to anticipate questions that I might be hearing in people's minds when they hear this, because they say, well, first off, you had $5,000 to put in to a business, and that sounds like a gamble to people. For you, it also sounds like it was not much of a gamble, because you guys had a strategy and a mission and knew what was next for you. And just give me a second here, because the other thing that I see is that you guys had learned so much prior to this this joint venture becoming a real corporate partnership, that you had a lot behind you. It sounds to me like you had the ability to work for a few months without taking pay from the company, those kind of things. And so explain that a little bit, and the kind of where a newbie would fit into this whole model versus somebody who might be in it a little while and see an opportunity.
Yeah, so our real costs to get started, David, weren't anywhere near $10,000.
Uh-huh.
It was a nice round number that we thought we wanted to put in the bank to get started.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it took, I think it cost us about $1,600 to file all the corporation paperwork, and it only cost that much because we filed it with, like, you know, everything in a rush. We didn't want to wait. We want it right now, so that was like double the cost. The attorney, if I remember correctly, had a flat fee to set up the buy-sell agreement, and we wanted to set all that stuff up right away. So, yeah, we did have, you know, we did have the luxury of having some funds available that we could put in the business. But it certainly didn't take $10,000 to get started, and I know you can get started for a lot less. I will also tell you that we started with the correct systems, or a version of the system that I'm going to show you today,
mm-hmm.
that we're going to talk about today, that made us actually start getting paid right away. So what I mean by that, you said, you know, we had the luxury of not having to take money out of the company for a while. That's actually not true. Well, while we invested the money in January, we didn't start really the business until March. We didn't start selling. If we had started selling in January, we would have started getting paid in January. As soon as we get started, our mindset was that we were not going to work for free. We actually talked about it. In late February, we said, you know what? So let's put our financial plans together, right? Let's put our forecast together, and let's just go ahead and plan on starting to get paid in June, right? And to me, it was, you know, it sounded good, right? You start a business, you go a couple of months, and then you start taking a nice salary. And then that conversation only that train of thought only lasted about 15, 20 minutes. Because then we said, you know what? And we kind of came to the conclusion together, forget that. We're going to get paid from day one.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to have to make it happen so we get paid. So not only did we get paid in March, we actually took back what we call our shareholder loans, our $5,000 each. We took that back in March. Now, we didn't take a huge salary, but what we decided also had to do with the mindset thing, what you wrote on the screen. I don't want to work for free.
Yeah, and so, that's a huge one, by the way.
When we talk about, that is a huge one. And here's something that I'll toss out there, David. You know, I said I had $5,000 to invest in this business, and that might sound like a lot of money at one time for somebody. But I would challenge anybody here who's been trying this IM game, this internet marketing game, for over 9 months to a year. And I challenge you to add up all of the expenses that you've had in buying courses and buying software and trying paid advertising and whatever it is that you've spent. And I can almost guarantee that you've spent more than $5,000. 90% of the time, 90% of the people here probably will tell you that they've spent more than $5,000 in a year, or close to that at least, you know, trying all this stuff.
I've got people on my list who have done that, so I know that's a fact.
Yep.
It's pretty amazing. Okay, so you're not working for free, and that's a really important piece of the mindset. And so now we're getting into what drives the production and the revenue and the generation. So I think we probably should jump down to the system that you want to get into a little bit. Is that good?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. And I put that, we're going to come back to some of these later, but I'm trying to put these in the right spot. And I have this under the finance thing. And I assume you're talking about the spreadsheet system. Is that right?
Yeah, let's go. Why don't we start with our spreadsheet?
Okay. So the people should be able to see this. This is a couple of images. We'll have several images here from Will. And there are four of them. Where are the examples? I had that right here in front of me. Where'd it go? Under finance. There we go. Now we're talking.
Yeah, I don't quite see your screen. I see one under your... I see one spreadsheet with some red and an arrow there. Is that the one
that's
you're
not the one.
Looking at?
Here it comes. It's a little lag.
There we go. All right.
Know your cost.
Yeah, and it's a little bit big, huh? Okay, there we go.
There, how about that?
I can see it. All right. So one of the things that we've always done is track our expenses very closely. And I know, David, that most people that I've ever talked to don't know what the costs are in their business. They just spend and spend and spend, and they bring their, you know, they want to get their money, their salary on a monthly basis, and then figure out how to make ends meet and, you know, allocate money towards this piece of software, this new training or whatever. But they don't know what their real costs are. So one of the exercises that we teach our coaching clients to go through is outline all of their expenses and know what it costs to run their business. So the first thing that we ever did was outline everything that was going to that we were going to spend money on, whether it's one time or on a monthly basis. And so we created a very, very simple spreadsheet. And this is what you see in front of you now. And we categorize them into two major categories: fixed expenses and variable expenses. So fixed expenses are those things that are going to be that are going to cost you the same thing every single month. Mm-hmm. Variable expenses are either one-time expenses or are expenses that change over time. And they may be expenses that you don't even incur on a monthly basis. So let's talk a little bit about those. This is the biggest mistake, and it gets a little bit into cash flow management, so I'm getting maybe a little bit ahead here, but let's try and synthesize this and make it simple. There are certain expenses that you're not going to incur every month, and most people forget about those expenses, and then all of a sudden they get hit with a major expense at one point in time, and that either breaks their business or gets them in real trouble. So we have a CPA, for example, that is going to file our taxes at the beginning, in March of every year, mm-hmm. right? And that's a significant expense. That costs us a couple of $1,000s to file our corporate taxes. I don't pay him every month to do that. But what I do is I account for that expense broken down every month, and I may save $200 a month in a savings account so that when it comes March of next year, I actually have that money sitting there to pay him. Mm-hmm. So that is I call that a variable expense. Really what we're doing is accruing for a future cost, but I put that down as a variable expense. Now, I may or may not save every month for this, so if I'm really tight on a particular month, I may not save, and I may save double on a different month. But what I want to accomplish here is I want to have, when that bill comes due, I want to be able to have that money sitting there.
Right.
So I account for that every month. Same thing with equipment and hardware. You may be fine with your computer right now, but what if your computer died next month and you have to go out and buy a new computer? Because we can't do this online stuff we do without a computer, right?
Right.
So instead of just hoping that my computer is going to last, I'm going to actually save a little bit of money every month so that when I do decide to go buy a new computer or a new tablet or a new phone or whatever, I have that money sitting there in a savings account ready to be spent, right? Mm-hmm. Ready to pay for that necessary expense. Another thing that a lot of people forget about is taxes when they start making money online, when they start generating revenue. You can't forget about taxes. So you got to put money away for your taxes, especially if it's the first time that you're going to start making, a significant income online, where you're not receiving a W-2 from an employee and your payroll taxes aren't being taken out, you're going to get hit with a big tax bill come April. So you got to make sure that you're saving all the money that you make. You're going to save some of that money for taxes. Okay. So that's the conversation on variable expenses. Now, I want you to notice something very important on the fixed expense category. There are two things there, salary and shareholder distribution. This is the money that we pay ourselves. Now, you have to think as a business owner, I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, David, but as a business owner, you play a couple of different roles in your business. Not only are you the business owner, but you're also an employee. When you run a small business, you have multiple roles, and you may actually be playing the role of multiple employees. But as an employee, you get paid a salary, and it is your responsibility to work in the business, to do the tasks that make the business run, whether it's doing the marketing or whether it's doing the customer service or whether it's doing both of those things and the product development on top of that. Right? Mm-hmm. So you do everything in the business. But you wear specific hats at specific times. As a business owner, you need to work on the business. You need to set strategy. You need to oversee the vision of the company and make sure that the company is going forward the right way. You're going to do the hiring and the firing. You're going to bring people into your business that can help you create systems that will help build assets in your business. So we outline there salary and shareholder distribution. So as an employee, you take a salary, and as an owner, you take a shareholder distribution. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail as to why you do that, and you separate it that way. There are tax implications, and your CPA can help you figure out what makes sense for you to take out of the business. But the bottom line is this. You have to get paid, and you have to treat the business not as your personal bank account. So we never go into the business and say, hey, I made $1,700 this week, let me go get that ATM card and pull that money out so that I can pay my bills and I can go have fun and buy that new toy or whatever it is I want to do. No, that $1,700 belongs to the business. If you want money out, you have to pay yourself. And if you're going to have to pay yourself, you're going to have to account for that expense. So we always account for our costs, David, the money that we take out of the business in both salary and shareholder distribution, as a cost to the company. Mm-hmm. And we outline that in our cost spreadsheet.
Now, does your shareholder distribution then fluctuate based on the company revenue?
Actually, our shareholder distributions do not fluctuate. We have increased them over time, but on a very planned basis. Mm-hmm. So, again, we don't want to treat this as a you don't want to treat the business bank account as your personal, you know, ATM.
Sure.
So, yes, you can increase your size. You can get a raise. You can get bonuses, you know, but they need to be planned according to what we're showing here on the spreadsheet.
Okay.
Flip over to the next slide, and we'll start making a little bit more sense of the system. So the very first step is to outline the costs. You have to know everything that costs the business. And that cost includes your money that you're going to take away.
Okay, so now you should be see the profit targets.
Okay, perfect. So the way to grow a business very successfully is to, after you understand your cost, you need to figure out how much you're going to want to profit, right? And you have to plan for profits. A lot of businesses plan for revenue and how much money they're going to make. But revenue doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. I could make $4 million a year in revenue and be broke. I could make $4 million a year and be bankrupt, right? If my costs exceed what I make, it doesn't matter how much I make, right? So what you want to really be focused on is your profitability. How much money do you actually get to keep in the bank? And following up with that whole concept of your bank, your business not being your personal ATM, we have to account for the fact that the business bank account has to grow. This business has to be, over time, continuing to get richer and richer. Now, as the owner of the business, that is your money. You're eventually going to get that money. You're eventually going to cash out. You're going to sell. You're going to, close the business, whatever. That is your money. But you can't be focused. You can't be taking that money out of the business all the time. You have to allow it to grow. We don't have a whole lot of time here today, David, for us to go into a very, very deep strategy, but maybe you can extrapolate on this later. The business can have lines of credit. The business will have relationships with banks and merchant accounts. The business can become an investment, an owner of investments to further grow your asset portfolio and so forward. The business can't do any of those things if you're constantly cashing out and zeroing out your bank account. So the business has to grow as its own entity. And that's why we want to focus on profitability. Now notice that my salary and my shareholder distribution, along with all of my other costs, are what the business needs to make just to break even. But since we're not in business to just break even, because that would just be having a job, right? We're in business to grow and to become more and more profitable, then our formula and the way we do things is we want to apply a percentage of profitability above the costs. So in the example here for the month of July, our costs are $5,569.85. And we've decided that we want to have 10% profit above that. So we're going to make, in profit, after our costs, we're going to be left in the bank with about $550, $56 or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. In some sense. So we want to make sure that we hit that profitability target. So whatever we do for the month of July, we want to hit that profitability target. Now, notice that the costs increase over time. The profitability percentage increases over time. So when we started our business, you know Jason and I a little bit, David, and you know that we're very, very ambitious.
Right.
Like ambitious as in like we achieve our goals, right? We're very aggressive when it comes to business growth. We're both overachievers in a sense, and we like to challenge ourselves. So we started our profitability target that first month that we did real business, March of 2011. We started with a 25% net profit target. 25%. And then in April, we went to 30%. And then we grew at 10% every single month until we reached 100% over total cost. So by the end of that year, if our costs were 20 grand, our net profit target was 20 grand on top of it. So we had to make 40.
Wow.
To be able to pay for those costs.
Okay. And so, what does that do for you? By having this on a piece of paper, looking at it, how does that translate into the way you run your business?
Yeah, so let's go to the next slide.
And before we do that, I want to tell you a very quick story from the cruise that I was just on 2 weeks ago. I talked to one of the marketers there who is a massive marketer. Everybody knows him. And he said that he was doing $6 million a year in business. And his expenses were $6.5 million a year. And he did that for 2 years, thinking he was going to wait out the recession. And then the bank closed one of his major credit card accounts because of some negative publicity or something. And it stripped $450,000 a month from his recurring revenue. So all of a sudden, you know, profitability becomes a really important thing. He went from $500,000 a month in expenses down to $60,000 a month in expenses. And now those are large numbers, but for a business that is that large, it doesn't matter, like you said, how much revenue you got. So we thought this guy was making tons of money, and he was actually underwater. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, you'd be surprised, David, like when we start looking especially at the guru market, what really goes on behind the scenes, because a lot of gurus that, you know, a lot of the people in the IM market specifically look up to and think they're doing so well because their marketing is so great and they tout the whole lifestyle thing, they're just in that whole make money online mindset, and they don't have real businesses either.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just sad to observe, but we've seen it time and time again. So if you just adopt this mindset of focusing on your net profit targets, the business. Let's go on to the next slide, and we'll show what else we're going to do with that.
Okay.
That is a very, very simple formula for you to achieve what you're going to do. So the next step is, and this, by the way, goes hand in hand with your six major bullet points, which is the dream and plan and
right.
I forget the other ones,
yep.
But. This follows that plan pretty much to a T. We have slightly different names for the steps, but it fits very well in your model. So once we have our net profitability target, then we have we go create a plan so that the net profitability number becomes a target, our goal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to plan to achieve that goal. And the way we plan, and by the way, this is exactly the way we do it, is we break out another sheet on our spreadsheet, and we put in all the days of the month, and then we put in activities that we're going to do to bring in a certain amount of revenue that will yield a certain amount of profit. So on day one, for example, we're going to promote an affiliate product, and our gross revenue is going to be $200, and that's our commission, so the profit is the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
On day two, we may release a product that's our own, and we're going to pay affiliate commissions and merchant fees and some advertising. So maybe we'll make $300 in gross revenue, but our real profit is about $135, let's say, after all those fees and expenses associated with the product. So what we do is we literally create a plan for every single day, what we're going to do and how much revenue that activity is going to generate. Now, this is the biggest hang-up, David, that people have. This is the absolute biggest hang-up that people have, is believing that you can actually forecast how much money you're going to make. How many people believe on this call that you can figure out exactly how much money you're going to make on a specific day ahead of that day.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? Yeah, so people.
Do you believe this, David?
I do believe this. In fact, I like I would add a third column to this to hold myself accountable to say, what did I do that day? So did
awesome.
I?
Okay.
Did I hit it or did I exceed it? I absolutely believe
all
that.
All right.
But I want to tell you too. I'm a late convert
this, right?
to this. I'm a late convert.
By the way, you've been doing this.
I have been.
Great, and so have a lot of our other coaching students. And let me tell you, this works. I started doing this in March of 2011 when we started the business, right? And by December of 2011, following that same plan, we had done over $1.8 million in business by following this exact plan. Mm-hmm. Now, again, we're a little bit short on time here today, so I can't go very deep into this, but hopefully David will extrapolate a little bit more for you later. The thing is this. By doing this, you're going to be extremely focused. One of the biggest problems that we have as we try to build an online business is that we don't know what to do. We're very easily distracted by bright, shiny objects and new things and all the emails we get from these marketers who are promising like the most amazing things in the world and the most amazing results with the push of a button. So then we go spend time reading the sales letter, and most of the time we get sucked in and we actually buy it, and then we spend time watching videos and learning things and trying new things until the next day when we get the next email from a different marketer who's promising an even better thing because it's push button, and the thing we bought yesterday, gosh darn it, we had to work to make it, you know, produce. Mm-hmm. So who wants to work? Forget that. Let's go buy this new thing, right, and focus on this new thing. So none of the activities that we do on a day-to-day basis have a real potential on that given day to make money, mm-hmm. to bring in revenue. So if you start focusing on what is the activity that I can do today to bring in real revenue, that will make a significant difference in your daily activities. That is going to give you increased focus. It is going to keep you from guessing what it is that you're going to do. And there's something else about this. I call it not being too proud to make money. Mm. A friend of mine once told me, hey, you know what? You can't be too proud in your business to make money. And I said, what do you mean? He was like, well, there are certain things that you're just not willing to do. If you're willing to do them, if you're willing to be open-minded, you might be very, very successful, right? So let me give you a very extreme example. Very extreme example. If I told you, David, let's say, David, let's go back to those 2 years where you fumbled and
right.
you weren't making money.
Right.
And I said, David, I have a project I need some help with. You know how to do it. It's going to probably take you 3 days of work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to, 3 solid days of work, I'm going to pay you $20. Will you do it? Most people's reaction is like, hell no, I'm not going to work 3 solid days for $20. Forget that.
Yeah,
right?
I was going to say, wait a minute, is this a trick question?
Yeah, I mean, of course, who's going to work 3 solid days?
Uh-huh.
Make it 2 days.
Yep.
2 solid days, David. You live in Florida, in
Alabama,
Florida, right?
Yeah, Alabama.
Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you live in Alabama. It's not very cheap to live there. You can't live on $10 a day,
nope.
right?
Nope.
Nope. So, but you're going to work for 2 days for $20? Of course you're not going to work for 2 days for $20. But then think back to those days, David, when you weren't making any money, you're fumbling 2 years. How many days, how many weeks, how many months, how many hours did you spend in front of a computer making $0?
Or negative.
Or negative, because you're spending money, you're buying stuff,
yep.
right?
Yep.
So everybody here is or has been at a place where they're willing to work weeks on end for $0, but they wouldn't take $20 to work for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
How does that make sense?
So it's an easy call if the $20, if I look at it and I say, well, I'm going to make $20, but I'm going to learn a ton in this 2 days that's going to help me make money later.
Yeah, so I mean, this is an extreme example, and I'm really exaggerating here to make a point, right?
Yep.
But the point becomes, we are too proud to make money because we're too good to work for $20, mm-hmm. right? So if you take a more realistic approach, as the chief operating officer of my business, I don't want to answer help desk tickets, right?
Yep.
But if answering a help desk ticket is going to make me money, I go in there and do it. And by the way, answering help tickets makes me money. I don't want to do it all the time. I don't want it to be my full-time job. But there is no activity that I will give an employee or that I will outsource that I'm not willing to do myself.
Mm-hmm. I heard of...
So you have to be open-minded. So you have to be open-minded. So one of the examples that we teach our clients, to our coaching clients, to learn this process, because it's one thing for you to be here, and I'm, you know, I hope I'm a trustworthy guy, and David is a trustworthy guy. You know him. It's great. It's one thing to be here on this call, and we tell you, hey, you can really predict and you can really forecast how much money you're going to make. So do this. And it's like, okay, I believe you, David. I believe you will. But you believe us kind of intellectually. You don't believe us. You're not willing to put your next paycheck on this, on the line, mm-hmm. right? You're not willing to put your next, you know, month's, you know, rent on the line on this because you don't believe it to your core. It's not ingrained in you, right? And that's totally fine because it's a difficult concept to believe and to understand. So what we do with our coaching clients, David, is we tell them the very first thing you need to do in order to learn this process and truly believe in it so that you can put it to work for yourself is this. You don't focus just on business activities that are specifically related to your business. You focus on any way possible that you can meet that net goal, regardless of what it is, as long as it's legal and ethical, right? Let's put a fine line there, right? Mm-hmm. As long as it's legal and ethical, be open-minded and don't be too proud to make money and do whatever it takes to go make that money for that day. And once you start doing that, it doesn't matter what the activity is. Once you start doing that and you can see, gosh darn it, if I put my mind to work and if I'm open-minded and if I'm not too proud to make a few bucks, I really can plan for how to make money. And then you take that knowledge and that belief and you can easily transport it, translate it into your business. Mm-hmm. So let me give you some examples. Like when I will never forget this example when I first taught this concept. And it's the funniest thing because I said something on a webinar training and it like became this huge, massive discussion in our members area. And it was like, man, at first I regretted saying those words because I just pulled it out of nowhere, right? I said, and the quote was this. I said, I don't care if you have to bake cakes and sell your cakes to make money. And then the discussion became, well, how does baking cake help me in my online business? Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't, right? And so we had this whole discussion and it became our primary example. The point is that I don't care what you do, and it doesn't have to be in your business. The point is that this is an exercise. It's like going to the gym for the first time. You don't do the whole circuit, and you don't go for the maximum weight and the maximum repetitions. You start slowly, right? You try out the machines, and you do a little bit of the treadmill, and you work up your way to your maximum potential. This is kind of the same thing. So what you do is you come up with a plan to meet your net target, no matter how it is. So let me give you some crazy examples. You know, if you needed to do $100 in a day, one of your days was $100 that you needed to make, could you have a garage sale?
Sure.
Could you sell something on eBay?
Sure.
Could you get paid for babysitting for a neighbor? Could you, you know, sell something that you're, I mean, just, could you have a car wash? I don't know. Do whatever it takes and be open-minded and not too proud to just hit that number. And I will tell you, there will be no better feeling, I don't care what it is that you do, there will be no better feeling than when you get and you look at your spreadsheet and you track what's going on, and at the end of the month, you've hit that number. You won't care that you had to bake a cake. You won't care that you had to babysit or sell some stuff on eBay or list something on Craigslist or whatever it is, right? or install a WordPress website for somebody, or set up an autoresponder, or help somebody install a plugin, or it doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter how much money that activity generated. It won't matter if you had to work 2 days to make $20, because that was the last $20 you needed to make your target. Mm-hmm. And once you do this and you start believing in this process, because your mind subconsciously, you're going to start believing the next month when you create the plan and you say, well, I got to make 150 this day, I got to make 300 that day, this is the activity I'm going to do, you're going to see, and your brain is going to start working, that it truly is possible, because you're going to have proof within yourself. You will have seen it already at work, and you're going to know that it works.
Yeah, so well, I want to give you an example of something. Two things. First is that I have my daily plan. I have my marketing plan. I missed it yesterday. I just flat got busy and did not send out my marketing email yesterday. And I was miserable all day long because I knew I had failed on my target for yesterday. And once you get this embedded in you, it becomes something you got to do. I mean, it becomes something that just you have to do because it's so important to your business. And I knew that I was failing yesterday and I couldn't stand it. But I had to do other things. And so I should have dropped that and just made this my top priority, and I didn't do it.
Yep. And so what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to make that up somewhere.
Yep.
Because you failed one day and that's fine. But guess what? You can't fail the month.
Nope.
That's tragic.
Yep.
So you're not going to fail the month, right?
Not failing the month. So here's the other example I wanted to give you. You said do anything. In 2003, my wife and I wanted to go to Africa on an Africa safari and meet my family or her family that lived in Ethiopia and do it together. We didn't have the $6,000 it was going to take to do it. We did have a shed full of stuff. And so I started selling stuff on eBay, and I had a plan just like this. How much money do we need? And we needed $6,000, and we ended up putting $8,000 in about 4 months in our PayPal debit card, and took that to Ethiopia with us and came back with $3,000 still on the debit card. And it was exactly this plan, you know, and it was, what do I have to do to get this money? Because we didn't have it. And
yep,
that's what you do.
Yep, that's exactly. And so this plan, so take the next column that you were mentioning, so we had that on the next slide there, is you not only plan for it, but you actually track the actual profit. So that's the third column there. So we had planned for $200. It went a little better than expected, so we made $10 more than what we wanted. We made $210. The next day, we had planned for $135 in profit, went a little bit lower than expected. You know, 125. The next day went a little better, and then a few days after that went a little better. But basically, you just go down and you track and you adjust. So if certain things aren't working, you adjust and you plan and you add another thing on your list, but you have to create a realistic plan for the month. Now, here's the thing. Very, very, very important. The plan has to be realistic, and your target has to be realistic. Although I may want to take a $3,000 salary, and I may want to take a $1,000 shareholder distribution, and I may want to save for a new computer and so forth, you have to see whether that's truly realistic for you. Do you have the means realistically? Because here's the other problem, right? Because of the gurus, because of the sales letters, and because of the promise magic button systems, everybody thinks that they can go in and make $10,000, $20,000, $100,000 their first month. And that can happen. It happens to some, but it's just not realistic for the masses. So you have to think within your means. Like, our monthly numbers are, you know, in the six figures, right? Every month, our net profit target are in the high six figures. And we do it. We have the means. We have the infrastructure. We have the customer list. We have that. You know, all that on our favor because we've built it over time. Our initial plan for March of 2011 was much, much, much smaller than that because we didn't have the means yet to be doing six figures a month. So plan accordingly. You know, don't feel bad about putting a $10 or $20 target on a specific day because that's realistic for you. Now, with that said, I also want you to stretch yourself a little bit, mm-hmm. right? If $10 is, you know, you can generate $10 every day in 15 minutes. then don't put $10 a day. Try and generate 30 or 40 that mm-hmm. day, right? Try and work 45 minutes to an hour to do that. I don't know. Try and do whatever it takes to stretch yourself a little bit more than what you're comfortable with, because you always have to continue to expand.
So I want to ask a question about this because each of these lines, I think, represents a deeper system for you. So, for example, if you have a webinar for XYZ and your gross revenue is $1,000, you want $450 in profit, how do you make sure that you hit that number? And do you know your numbers well enough that you know how many people have to be on, how many affiliates have to promote, all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so that part of it, David, and that's probably a little bit more of an advanced
sure.
Example, because over time, you become better at this and you start understanding your metrics and your number and your capabilities, right? So David is absolutely right. When we do like a webinar promotion or when we launch a product, we know really, really well ahead of time how much money that's going to make. And 9 times out of 10, we are right on or we exceed the target, because I know that if I want to, let's say, do $10,000 on a webinar, I have to get X number of people to attend the webinar live, and then I have to mail the replay X number of times after that. And if I can't get that number myself of people myself on the webinar, then I have to get affiliates to promote that webinar as well. And I know by now, I've been here in business for 3 years, I've been working with these affiliates, I know that if I can get my top two affiliates to promote that, then I'll make that number. But if the top two aren't available or aren't willing to do it, then I might have to get the next 5 or 6, so I'll go after the next 5 or 6. And if some of those aren't available, then I might have to go after 10 to 15 smaller affiliates and so forth. So you get to know your metrics and you get to know what your capabilities are. We're truly, like, we go even into affiliate promotions and say, this is the product, this is how much the price of the product is, this is the interest level of our audience usually for this type of product, so this is our target for how much we're going to earn in affiliate commissions. Mm-hmm. And I was in a mastermind meeting here in December, just last month, and one of the people in the room we had just promoted, and so we were actually teaching the same concept in the mastermind. And so I pulled out my December plan, which I had developed in November. We always develop a month ahead of time. And I said, by the way, remember that promotion that we just did for you last week? Here's what we plan to make. And it was something like $21,000. And we did $22,000. And so he was pretty impressed that we were able to forecast exactly how much we're going to make. So the point here is that you do get better. You start understanding your capabilities. And as you track, you start to understand your metrics. And this process becomes easier and easier and easier and easier over time. And that should be your goal.
Yeah, so I want to make sure that people understand the one word there I think really is key to this, and that is track. Because if you don't track, you have no idea what you did, right?
Exactly.
Yep, yep.
So the most basic tracking, of course, is just tracking the profitability from a specific activity.
Yep.
And if you have activities that, you know, always do very well, then you continue doing them. If you have activities that always flop, then you stop doing them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have talked about this finance system a lot. Is there more that you want to add to this, or should we move on to like other systems that you're using?
No, I think we can move on, and we can always come back to this if there are more
sure.
questions or if we need to refer back to it.
I think that we also have a screenshot from you for the support system as well.
Yep.
So talk about support and how a lot of people say support is an expense, but I know that in the corporate world, we always thought of support as a profit center. That if you weren't turning that into a profit center, then you needed to look at how you were doing support. How do you guys do support?
Yes, that is absolutely right, David. Most people think of support as a cost. Oh my gosh, I gotta hire somebody to do support, or I gotta spend my time doing support, or whatever. I look at it from there are two things that the two easiest ways to grow a business, the easiest way to grow a business is to increase the lifetime value of your customer. That is the easiest way to grow a business, to grow revenue. That means that it's easier to sell to an existing customer, it's easier to sell them a second and a third and a fourth product than it is to acquire a new customer and sell a product for the first time. So when you think of it in those terms, you realize that if you can increase the lifetime value of a customer and you increase revenue, what are the ways that you can increase the lifetime value of a customer? One of them is customer support. If you have excellent customer support, customers will come back to you and continue buying from you because you're providing them with a good experience. The other way, of course, is to develop more internal systems and become more efficient with what you do and how you do and how you interact with customers in every other way, like your marketing and your delivery platforms for your products and so forth. But let's focus on support here. Support is an absolute key, and I sent David the screenshot of our help desk metrics because we track them very closely. This is my baby. I love managing the support organization, and we focus very, very closely on continuing to grow that organization, making sure that our support staff is well trained and we use the right software and we've created the right procedures so that we can achieve these metrics that you see here. So our customer satisfaction rating will range anywhere between 95 and 98%. When you compare that to the industry benchmark for a software company at 86%, you can see that the significant advantage that you have. You'll never achieve 100%, by the way. People get very upset when, even if you provide great support, but you tell them that, no, that's not possible, or no, we can't do that, no, sorry, we can't give you our product for free, they will rank you as, they'll give you a negative review. Mm-hmm. So a 95% satisfaction rating, or 96 or 97%, is almost unheard of for customer support. And so we're very proud of that. And as you can see, we handle a lot of tickets. We handle, anywhere between 2,500 and 3,500 tickets per month. The reason we handle that many tickets is because we encourage our customers to talk to us. We encourage our customers to communicate. We make it super simple for them to find us. Every single members area for our products has a link to support at the very top. Every single one of our pages has a support link on the bottom of it. Our sales copy usually has a link to our support on it. If they reply to any of the emails that we send out, it goes directly to our help desk. So it is super, super simple, no matter how they want to communicate with us, to get a hold of our support team. Our average first response, as you can see there, 1.1 hours. 76% of our tickets get answered in less than 1 hour. By the way, this is across a 24/7 time frame.
Wow.
24/7 time frame, because that's how the software tracks it. We don't quite have 24/7 support. So there are some hours, there are some days and some hours in the middle of the night where there isn't anybody working. So if I truly had a 24/7, this would be even better. And if we were only counting the business hours, this would be insane. So a lot of our tickets get answered within minutes, right? Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is 99% of all tickets get answered within 8 hours or less. 99% of our tickets. And no tickets ever go 24 hours. So this is a matter of setting procedures, setting expectations, having the right staff there. But how does this become a profit center for us? First of all, we are very clear in our marketing that we are not the low-cost provider. We are always charging premium prices for our products, which means we get more profit out of our products. We don't sell products for $7. We don't sell products for $17. We sell products at the $50 to $500 to $1,000 range. Mm-hmm. And a customer is happy to buy from us and pay more because they know that we're going to be there for them. Customers will pay for that premium experience. Why is Nordstrom's in business? Because they cater to an audience that wants a shopping experience. Same thing with other high-end stores. They want that brand. They want to shop from a brand that is going to be there, that is going to provide them the experience. So customer support becomes a very, very key element of your profitability. It is a profit center because it reduces refunds. It is a profit center because it keeps customers coming back. They have no qualms about coming back and buying from us again because, again, they know that we will be there. And it is a profit center because we literally use this screenshot now in our marketing activities. So when Jason is pitching on a webinar or Jason is writing a sales letter, he says, here are our support statistics. We're clear as day that we are going to provide you support, right? And so this helps us in our marketing activities. Our customer service agents often cross-sell or they recommend other products to customers. And so you can absolutely turn your help desk, maybe not as a direct profit center, but as an indirect revenue generating arm of your company. And I'm a very, very, very strong believer in it. And we focus very heavily on this, David. I spent countless hours creating processes, training people, making sure that we have procedures in place and that we track these metrics, right? And if something slips, then we dive in and we figure out how to fix it. We hire staff. In our case, we've gotten to the point where we hire staff before we need them. So I just hired another help desk agent last month. We don't need one. You can see our metrics. We don't need one. But we have some new things that are going to be coming down the pipe in the next couple of months. So I hired her last month because I want her to be well-trained. And in a couple of months, I'm going to hire another one ahead of schedule. I don't need it. So a big mistake that people make is like, oh, my God, our support is overwhelmed. Now we got to go hire somebody. But then by that time, things have already hit the fan, right?
Sure.
And so I'm a very, very strong advocate of growing your support organization and creating your processes as quickly as possible.
So you have grown from, was it just you and Jason in the beginning, or did you have other people involved?
It was Jason and myself, and we had a couple of part-time contractors helping.
Okay. Yeah. And now you are how many people in your organization?
I lose track of the number, but I think it's either 18 or 19 full-time people.
Okay. How many of those people are in support?
We have, I believe, 8 full-time dedicated support staff, and then another 6 that also do escalation support and help out of the help desk.
So at least 50% of your people are in support.
More than that.
Okay, so that's a real tribute to how much you think support is part of a good ongoing business with great assets. And I'm going back to your buy-sell agreement and your exit strategy and all of that, and support being a key player in that entire thing really helps build that bond between you and the customers, right? So that to me is a really huge asset, and it's one that doesn't show up necessarily as a line item on your balance statement. But the goodwill part of it, it does.
That is a huge asset to us, David, in so many ways. So let me give you an example. So last year we promoted very few things as affiliates. We entered 5 big promotions. 2 of them were for the same product. It was a relaunch, and these two happened to be the largest internet marketing launches in all of 2013. And all of these 5 launches that we entered had affiliate contests. And we won every single affiliate contest that we entered. And I will tell you, our support was critical to us winning those contests because we were able to leverage our support infrastructure to be able to help us take care of customers and solve issues and help customers ordering and answering questions about the product in contacting customers that had questions and making sure that they were taken care of. In every single case, we integrated some of our staff with the vendors for the products, right? Because there is no other vendor out there that we know of that provides this level of support. Mm-hmm. So when a customer had an issue ordering or had a question about the product, they may have been waiting for days for an answer from the vendor, who was probably very overwhelmed with their lack of support for a big launch, right? What we did is we told our customers, don't go to the vendor, come to us. We will go through our back channels to the vendor, get you the answer, and we will help you solve that problem so that you can order and be happy with this product.
Wow, that's a huge difference in the way most people do these things.
So we don't go into a big affiliate promotion without having a backline to their support, right, that can answer us quickly. We have cell phone numbers. We have them on Skype chat. Yep. We have their direct emails, right? So we're going to get preferential treatment for our customers because we can go get the answers that they can't get just because, you know, their ticket may be buried in some help desk system that they're using with thousands of other tickets and thousands of other requests, mm-hmm. right? So there's another way that our help desk, that our support team helps us be more profitable.
Hmm. So you're actually augmenting other people's support with your own staff.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
and the results in a lot more sales for us, a lot more affiliate commissions, and we win contests. And you know, bottom line is, we make more money.
Sure.
So it's a huge, huge asset, David. Let me go on a slight tangent here because this is another area where we have a different mindset than most people in our marketplace. Most people in our marketplace are taught that you should outsource, right? But most people have a view of outsourcing that is like going to Fiverr or going to Odesk and paying people to do specific tasks or paying people for working a specific number of hours. We do not hire those types of, we do not use outsourcing in that fashion. Mm-hmm. Every single person that works for us, we consider an employee and we treat them as employees. Now, officially speaking, some of them that are outside of the country, they're not true employees, they don't get payroll, right? But we treat them as employees, we want them to work for us full time, and they have all the benefits that an actual employee in the U.S. would get. They get their 2 weeks vacation, they get email addresses at rapidcrush.com, they're part of our Skype group, they're part of our employee directory, we have performance review calls with them. Every single person that works in the Rapid Crush team is an employee in our eyes. Whether some would consider them a contractor or whatever, we don't care. We consider them employees. And that makes a significant difference in how they perform and how they produce. They are vested in our success.
Okay.
They're not just somebody that they're not just somebody on Odesk that we're going to push a button and say, I don't need you anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So if somebody's not working out, just like I would have a performance evaluation and create a performance plan for an employee in a traditional company, right, I will do exactly the same thing with somebody that is outside the country that I, you know, that I hire officially as a contractor. Everybody's an employee. That's how we treat them. I think that mindset is significantly different than anybody else in our industry.
Well, you're,
and that has served extremely well.
You're going against the grain again there. That's right.
Yeah. I just take, for example, you know, we have several people in the Philippines, mm-hmm. right? And we fund a Christmas party for them at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, we do things for our employees here, we do things for our employees there. And they love it. They love working for us. They would do anything for us. Some of them have been with us from the very, very beginning. So we have employees outside the country that have been with us for almost 3 years.
Do you have management in those areas?
We absolutely do. I could not manage our entire help desk staff myself and train them. So we very quickly hired a help desk manager who actually manages the staff directly.
Okay.
Her direct reports.
How about other areas of your business? I know Dave Gamage does a lot of your technology system stuff. Now, do you have other areas of the business that you think are systematized, or is all of your business systematized in some way like that?
Well, there's always more stuff to systematize, sure. Right? No, we're not completely turnkey yet, but we will always strive to be, and there will always be things that we will create more systems, fine-tune the systems, etc. We are still a fairly small business in our eyes, mm-hmm. So many of us wear different hats, right? But one of the things that I always look at when I wear different hats is separating in my mind the different functions that I may be serving within the organization. So I'll give you my particular example. For the last, for 2.5 years, I was both the chief operating officer and the chief financial officer. Mm-hmm. So I had two very distinct roles within the organization. And it's kind of funny because those two roles at times conflict. And I would find myself being conflicted because as an operations guy, I want to do this thing. As a finance guy, I know we really shouldn't do this thing, right? Because of the financial implications. And so I had to reconcile those two. So for a while, I was running both of those. Mm-hmm. We got to a point where we hired a CFO, and that was last August. And so last August, I was able to take this function that I was serving and pass it on to somebody else over time. And now she's self-sufficient. I no longer have anything to do with finances. I am now just the chief operating officer, and I focus completely on operations and customer service. Our other employees have, like Dave, for example, Dave wears multiple hats. Mm-hmm. Dave is handling the technology side, and Dave is also handling the project management side, are two of his many functions, right? I try and box those functions, like put the responsibilities in a box and almost create a virtual org chart in my mind as to like, well, I have this. I have the project manager position. I have the IT support position. I have positions A, B, C, and D. Now, in those boxes in that org chart, the same employee may be in several boxes. But over time, if you do that, you can then say, okay, now it's time to hire a dedicated project manager. Mm-hmm. And so Dave can step out of that role. Or maybe Dave will stay in that role and I hire a dedicated IT guy. And maybe I can hire a dedicated, somebody else in the finance group and so forth. So now it becomes very easy to figure out, as you're creating systems, what part of the business to grow. This is a concept that was partially taught in a book. What's the name?
E-Myth.
E-Myth. Yes, E-Myth.
Excellent book.
So you develop excellent book. Great strategy for allowing you to see what your business is about and creating systems and then hiring the right people to fulfill those roles. So yes, we still have multiple responsibilities. Jason has multiple responsibilities. Jason is a chief marketing officer, and Jason is a chief executive officer as well, right? Mm-hmm. And he was in the marketing area. He was writing most of our copy. So now part of that has been transitioning over the last year because we hired a copywriter. So Jason writes relatively little copy in the business these days. Eventually, Jason will float more and more and more towards just the CEO role, and we will have a chief marketing officer that we will hire. Mm-hmm. And we'll do the same thing throughout the business. We take these responsibilities in these positions and then just start filling them.
Yeah, you know,
but right now as a small business, we mostly wear lots of hats.
Yeah, and it's that book that we just mentioned, E-Myth, I think it's E-Myth Revisited, Michael Gerber. I actually read that book last year, and the first thing I did was go to the whiteboard and lay out all of the jobs on the whiteboard and started putting names in those boxes after I created the jobs. And it's just like you were saying, you start dropping in. When I did it, I had, I think, three people that were working with me. This was 2 years ago. I had three people that were working with me, but I was managing them all. So my name went in all of the boxes. And then the goal over time was just to focus on those as boxes and put the right person in the right box, right? And I love your idea of having a virtual org chart that you can just drop people into. Because the job doesn't change,
absolutely.
Just the face.
That's exactly right. And so at the highest level, and I mentioned this earlier, at the highest level, there are two positions that you fill. Like very generically speaking, you are going to fill two positions, the business owner and an employee, mm-hmm. right? And as an employee, you may actually fill the roles of a lot of employees. But at every step of the way, you have to recognize the roles that you're playing at any given time. So as a business owner, you're not answering the phone and answering customer support tickets, and you're not doing the marketing and all of that. As a business owner, you're setting the strategy and the vision and planning for the business, right? Mm-hmm. And advising the business. When you start doing those other things, you have to realize, oh, I'm no longer the business owner. Now I'm an employee. And you're absolutely right, David. Strategy versus tactics. I saw you wrote that.
Yeah.
So, an execution, you know, is part of the tactics, right? You're executing
That's right.
on the plan. That is what an employee does. An employee is building assets for your organization. The employee is managing the operations, is managing the day-to-day, is doing the actual work. So you really have to start thinking of these different roles that you play so that you can start growing your business. So I highly recommend that book, E-Myth. Everybody should read it.
Yeah, and before we get away, or you get away from us, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about some other things here, too. I know we're running out of time here. Let me just write this down. Okay. You guys got incorporated from the very get-go. Why did you do that?
So let me preface this by saying I'm not a CPA, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not giving you any legal or financial advice here. But I'll tell you my perception on it. This is just personal
sure.
Experience, okay? I knew when I went into business, when I started this thing, I knew very little about the benefits of incorporating, but I knew one thing. I knew that if I did it right, it would limit my personal liability. I also knew, because I had read some other books, that there are very good financial implications, and specifically around taxes, when you incorporate and you do it right. So I sought out the advice of my CPA, the guy who did my personal taxes mm-hmm. for so many years. I called him up and I said, look, I'm trying to do this. What's the best thing to do? And he said, yes, you're absolutely right. You need to incorporate and you need to do that. So it had to do with limiting your personal liability, and it had to do with tax implications. And especially when it comes to a partnership, you absolutely want to incorporate, because it's not just your actions, but the actions of your partner. And then when you have employees, it's the action of your employees that you know, can put you at risk. So those are the basic reasons, David. Do you want me to extrapolate on any of those?
The one thing that I really want people to understand, we have a lot of folks in NAMS who are operating as sole providers or sole proprietors instead of a corporate entity, and you can control your income, your personal income, and reduce your taxes so tremendously by going through a corporation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. On the personal liability, let me mention something that's very important for people to understand. Just because you incorporate, whether you form an S-Corp, a C-Corp, an LLC, whatever, whatever type of corporation you form, that doesn't automatically give you liability protection. And by liability protection, I mean this. Something goes wrong, somebody in your business gets hurt, there's some kind of loss, whatever reason, somebody doesn't like you, they're going to sue you, right? We're a very litigious society. Most developed countries are very litigious. And in a situation like that, if you're incorporated and if you do things right, they can't come out after your personal assets, your savings account, your retirement accounts, your home, your cars, your boats, whatever it is that you may have. They can't come after that, because they can only sue the corporation, because everything you do in your business, you're acting as a corporate agent. and the corporation is treated like a person. Now, the problem, or the thing that you have to be aware, is that in order for you to enjoy this type of liability protection, you need to make sure you're doing the right things, because just going out and incorporating doesn't provide you that automatically if you're not following the right procedures. And there's something called the corporate veil. And the corporate veil is what separates you from the corporation, and what really provides that liability protection. So if you are treating your business as your personal ATM, and you go out and you want to buy, some clothes, and you go out to Macy's and you take out the business credit card because you're the owner, right? It's a perk, and you start buying your clothes on the business credit card, and you go out and, you pay for, your child's braces with your business credit card, and you start doing things like that, then if you ever get sued, the person suing you, or their lawyer, is going to go after and look at those things and say, you know what? There is no separation of person and business. So this legal entity is nothing more than paperwork, because they've pierced that corporate veil. There's no real separation. So it's very important that you talk to your attorney, that you talk to your CPA, and you understand what it is you can and can't do with the business. From treating the finances to internal procedures and all of that, so that there is a true separation of your person and your business. It's one of the reasons why we get paid a salary and we get paid shareholder distributions. It's one of the reasons I don't go to the ATM and just take out some cash because I need for the weekend, right? Everything that we do is focused around separating our person from our corporation. So anyway, I think that's important for people to understand. Again, I'm not giving you legal advice here. Make sure you understand this stuff, though, if you're looking for liability protection or asset protection, that you understand that concept of piercing a corporate veil, not piercing a corporate veil, so that you can keep that. Because a lot of people, David, that I've talked to, they think that just because they form an LLC, they're protected.
Right.
And that's just not the case.
That's right.
The financial and tax implications, I learned this from Robert, first learned of this many, many years ago from Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad book.
I did too.
It's really cool, because let's say as an employee who works for a company, you earn $100,000, right? And out of that $100,000, these days, if you're in the top tax bracket and you live in California, you're going to pay 55% taxes on that stuff. Let's say give or take. Let's just say 50% to make it even, right? So you're going to pay $50,000 in taxes. Now you have $50,000 left over. Out of that $50,000, let's say that you have your car payments cost you a total of, let's say, you drive a nice car, so $5,000 a year, right? So now you have $5,000 you've spent out of your 50. So now you have $45,000 left, and out of that you have to pay your mortgage, and you have to pay your insurance, and you have to pay a whole bunch of stuff you have to pay. So you basically were left with $50,000 to spend. You've paid $50,000 in taxes. Now, I'm simplifying the numbers here for the example. If a corporation earned $100,000, then the corporation takes away all of its expenses. It takes away the salaries that it pays its employees. Maybe you have a company car that you drive, so that car payment comes out of the corporation's money. And you spend all of the money that you have to spend from the corporation, and let's say that you've spent a total of $50,000 in real business expenses, right? Mm-hmm. So now what you're left over with at the end of the year is $50,000 as your profits. Now the corporation is taxed on that $50,000. Mm-hmm. Not on the original $100,000 like the individual is, but just the $50,000 that's left over. And let's just say that it was in the same tax bracket and you ended up paying 50% in taxes. Well, 50% of $50,000 is just $25,000. Mm-hmm. So now you've taken your tax liability from $50,000 if you earned it as personal income and you've translated into 25,000 if you earned it as corporate income, because you're going to be able to deduct things before taxes are calculated. So you reverse the equation, and that's a very simplistic explanation. Now, of course, it's not as simple as that. It's not as simple as 2 plus 2, right? So you need, again, to have your CPA on your corner explaining to you what things you can charge to the business, what things you can't, and all of that stuff. But that's kind of a basic explanation, and that's another book that I highly recommend is Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yep.
Very good book. He has a whole series. I don't know how many books are in the series. And I'll tell you, read just the first book and don't get sucked into the whole series, because, man, he goes into some crazy stuff after that. And I'm not a real believer in all the follow-ups. But the first book is a must.
Yeah, and I will tell you that there is, when you talk about Robert Kiyosaki and the Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the whole light bulb thing went on for me. And then you start getting into the complications of what kind of corporations there are. That, really, you need to talk to your attorney and CPA about whether you do a C-Corp, an S-Corp, or an LLC, and what the benefits of each of those are for your business. But the tax liability and the ability to, the tax advantages. I tell people all the time that one of the first things that they need to do is evaluate whether they need to be a corporation. The benefits are huge for some businesses, and it's huge for me. And I know that I couldn't operate unless I. In fact, I've had a corporation, Maximized Communications, since 1987, and it's gone through different permutations as different businesses. And over that period of time, I've also had other corporations that we built different companies with and sold, or did for a while and then dissolved. And to get the corporate protection and the corporate benefits is pretty huge. Okay, let's see. So we've talked about finance, support, insurance, bank, your insurance example. I have a lot to go through a little bit later on insurance as well. Banking and accounting were big on my list. You've talked a lot about the accounting piece of it. I think we can go over that. Talk about your banking relationship as a business entity right now.
Okay, sure. So that is that all revolves around some of the things that I've already talked about related to separation of person versus business, and the profitability concept, where I want the business to become profitable. I think of it this way. We all want to become rich, yep. Right? We all want to make a lot of money and be wealthy. I also want my business to be rich. I want somebody to be able to look at my books, my profit and loss statement, and say, wow, this business is very, very profitable. You know how Apple has like billions and billions of dollars in the bank, mm-hmm. right? Hundreds of billions, whatever it is they have in the bank. Mm-hmm. I want to become that corporation someday, right? I want the business to have it. So they don't take all their money, and every time they make $100 million, they don't distribute $100 million out. They don't spend it. They don't give it to all their shareholders. They keep it in hand. And there are a lot of reasons to do that. For example, early last year, we acquired another company. We worked out a deal where we acquired all of the assets of another company because we had the cash to do it, right? So there are going to be opportunities that are going to present themselves for investments that you can make, for things that you can acquire, for products you can develop, for, you know, whatever, where you need to have money, and you don't want to be putting in your personal money into doing this. The business needs to stand on its own, just like you could go out and you can create investment accounts. The business can do that as well. Mm-hmm. And then you start getting those other advantages of liability protection and tax benefits. There's a lot of benefits to doing it. But anyway, again, a lot of people tend to treat their business as their personal ATM, right? So you have a PayPal account and you make $10,000, and the next day you go to your PayPal account and you withdraw all that money from PayPal, right? Something you should not do, right? We've focused a lot, again, from advice that I've gotten from our team over time, we focused a lot on developing our relationships with our merchant processors, developing our relationships with our banker, growing the level of money that is in each of those accounts and leaving it there, because we now have, for example, a dedicated PayPal representative, because we do enough volume, enough transactions through PayPal, and we leave enough money in our account where they treat us very, very well. We have a personal banker at Wells Fargo, so there's one person I can call and she takes care of me. I don't have to go to the branch to sign paperwork. We can do things via, you know, electronic means, and with a phone call I can have her transfer money between one account or another, because she has that personal level of relationship with me. We can open up lines of credit. We have business credit cards, and we have employee business credit cards that we use. We did a big launch last year, David, and we were able to go both to our merchant processor, who happens to be our bank, Wells Fargo, as well as PayPal, and get pre-approved to run $1 million in a month, something we hadn't done before, mm-hmm. right? And they looked at our books, and they looked at our finances, and they were like, yep, you're a solid business. You know, your cash flow is managed properly over the last 3 years. So, yeah, not a problem. You're not a risk. I don't know if I answered a question. I would like to go on another little tangent
sure.
here, especially when it comes to PayPal, because that seems to be a big thing when it comes to payment processing, or any other merchant provider for that matter. As you're starting a business, I'm sure people here, at least some people, have heard the stories of like, oh my gosh, PayPal shut down my account,
yep.
right? Or the credit card company credit card processor shut down my account. And they put the blame. It's always easy to put the blame on PayPal because they suck, or this merchant processor because they suck, and gosh, I'm the victim here, right? Or the person who got their account shut down is the victim. And you have to really take a step back and evaluate what is really happening here. When PayPal, and I'll just stick with PayPal as an example, but it's the same exact thing for any merchant processor. When PayPal takes a payment from one of your customers and puts that money in your account and makes that money available to you, PayPal is actually taking a risk. PayPal is actually virtually loaning you that money. It's like they're giving you credit, because once you take that money out, the customer who paid you can come in and file a chargeback.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, this is unauthorized, or I didn't get the service, or whatever happens. And they have, like, let's say they pay with the credit card, they have up to 6 months from the time they purchase the product to come in and dispute a charge. And a customer disputing a credit card charge and claiming there's fraud, usually the credit card companies will side with them, unless you have very, very good proof that this wasn't fraud,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what happens if you do $10,000 in a couple of days, PayPal puts all that money in your account, you withdraw it, then you close your bank account and you disappear, and then all of those customers come in and charge back. Who is going to be responsible or liable for that? PayPal is. PayPal is going to lose all that money. So every time PayPal lets you take money out of the account, they're actually providing you almost like a loan, right? They're trusting that you're going to be good for that money if somebody comes and complains and wants their money back. So they have to look at, when they're taking money in, when you're selling stuff, they have to evaluate the risk level that you present to them. And so if you have a PayPal account that has, you know, does a few hundred dollars a month, and all of a sudden you release a product and it does $100,000 in the weekend because you have a lot of affiliates promoting it, they look at it and say, whoa, 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 what's going on here? Our risk is very, very significant here. So they freeze your account because they want to make sure that for 6 months, you know, they're not going to lose that money, and now they're not going to let you use PayPal anymore, right? Unless you can prove to them that, hey, you're not a risk. You manage cash flow. You're a legitimate business, and you have, you know, enough assets to cover that, and then they'll reconsider and probably let you continue doing business with them. So the answer to all of those PayPal issues, and we put a product out couple of years ago on how to protect yourself from stuff like that, the answer is to use common sense. You know, most people that I know of, and boy, I tell them not to, most people that I know of, as soon as they get a significant amount of money in PayPal, they withdraw really fast just to make sure that it's safe, that PayPal doesn't, like, not going to lock it up for 6 months, right? And that is like, that is sending the exact wrong signal to them, right? It's like, oh man, this person always drains their account. So we keep a lot of money in PayPal, a lot of money in their account.
Interesting.
Because when I went to them and said, hey, I need to process $1 million, and I sent them all our documentation, all our profit and loss statements and all that, the answer was like, oh yeah, this is not going to be a problem. The only thing we ask you is that you leave plenty of money to handle refunds. But I see that you do that anyway, so that's not going to be an issue.
Cool.
You know, so you're telling them that it's like, you know, you're sending, you need to send the right message to them, and that's really important.
So it sounds like that they, even that is a relationship that is a real business relationship that has to be built over time.
Oh, absolutely, and you need to focus on it, and you have to, it, like any other relationship, it has to be win-win, and you have to consider the other side, what they gain out of it, right?
Yep.
And what their risk is, what's their potential loss. And win-win for us with PayPal, for example, or our merchant processors, is they want us to process a lot of transactions because they get paid. They take their fees on every transaction, mm-hmm. right? But at the same time, they're not going to just take a lot of our transaction money if there's a significant risk for them. So another win-win for them, another winning scenario is having customers like us that are low risk.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any different than going out and getting approved for credit. It really isn't. So you have to build that credibility for your business over time.
Right.
So focus on building credibility for your business by managing your finances properly. At the very, very basic level, let's step back a little bit from all these kind of strategies here that we've outlined, David. At the very, very basic level, you need to have a business bank account. You should never, ever receive money, get paid, or you should never spend money from your personal account. Let's say your business, let's say you're just starting your business and you don't have any money in your bank, in your business bank account to cover the HostGator hosting fee, right? You're totally broke. You have $1 in there and the HostGator fee is 10 bucks. Don't you ever, ever, ever use your personal credit card, your personal PayPal account, your personal check, whatever, to pay for that fee. What you do instead is you go to your bank, you withdraw money from your personal account, you deposit it in the bank account as a, in the business bank account, as a shareholder loan.
Yep.
You are loaning money to the business, and then you use the business account to pay for those expenses. So that's something very basic there that people need to understand.
Yeah, and
so a shareholder loan to the business, and then at some point when the business is making money, then you pay that loan back.
Yep.
And by the way, that does not incur taxes again.
I actually financed the first year of my business by I was a consultant, by doing shareholder loans to the corporation. And it was a significant amount of money. And I loved it in the second year because I paid those loans back. And we lived pretty large, but had very little income because we were paying a large loan back. And, you know, it works out great. And as long as you understand, and this is the reason for a good accountant, as long as you understand what you're doing there and that you do this in a trackable way through QuickBooks or whatever your accounting system is, you go from one line item to the next. And it's very easy to do and not complicated.
Yeah, I'll just say something about accounting because you mentioned QuickBooks. From an accounting perspective, you have to not just understand where your expenses are and what your costs are, you really have to track those things very clearly throughout the year. And you have to track them. The easiest way to track just so happens to be by separating it, by making every business expense paid out of the business credit card or out of the business checking account or, you know, however, out of a business account, so you don't ever spend your money personally. So at the end of the year, when you go do your taxes, you don't have to go search for all those darn receipts and try to figure out, well, this $3 here was parking for an event that I went to, and I paid it out of my own cash. And, you know, you don't have to figure out that stuff. It's all in the business, very easily categorized. So definitely talk to your accountant on how to keep track, but make sure that all business expenses are paid out of the business. without exception.
Yeah, and one of the best things I ever did was move all of my transaction reconciliation over to a bookkeeper, not a CPA, because I got a much less rate for somebody doing the grunt work. Then that goes to the CPA.
Right.
But the bookkeeper actually reconciles all of the PayPal transactions, categorizes everything, whether it is an affiliate commission payout or an affiliate commission revenue, or if it is a software membership or those kind of things, so that I can actually pull up reports in QuickBooks and understand exactly where the business is at any moment. And
exactly.
This is so important to do it either with your PayPal account or through credit cards. Like you say, I don't do anything by cash anymore because I want it tracked.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Very easy to get a business credit card, by the way. Most banks, when you open a business bank account, they'll give you a business credit card. It may not have a high limit or anything, but it's easy.
So, Will, this has been just a great amount of information today, and I can't believe you've been so generous with it. So thank you so much for doing this today. And we got some questions in from people, but they have been answered as we were going through. We've had some recommendations from some other people, and we had some praise from people. And this one I'll read. It says, "This is so incredibly valuable to gain insight into a truly successful IM business, not different from any other business. However, I think that is the least understood because the flood of quick income lure and the maze of incongruent information out there. To create a pure business and building management track with this part," she's suggesting I do this at the workshop, "to create a pure business building and management track with this part, finance, legal component, this is invaluable. Thank you for offering this workshop." So there you go.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, an IM business, she's absolutely right. An IM business shouldn't be any different than another business. Mm-hmm. A business is a business, and it doesn't matter what you do. All of these concepts that we talked about today are things that we've taught in our coaching program. And, you know, when I talked about it at the Arnold K. Day event last July, one of the guys in the audience came to me after the fact and said, "Man, I've been doing this stuff for over a year because I was in your coaching program, and I built a seven-figure business following these exact strategies, you know, of the planning, the forecasting, and so forth." So this stuff works.
Yeah, it does.
I do it. David does it. We have clients that are now paying us a lot of money to indoctrinate their staff into doing it, and they are getting tremendous success because the system works. So as simple as it is, don't get sidetracked by the simplicity of creating those little super simple spreadsheets, because they're not complicated. And by the way, you don't even need spreadsheets. If a spreadsheet software worries you, you can do the whole thing on paper because it's so simple.
Yep.
But just do it. Do it, and you will see tremendous results if you actually follow the process.
And the last thing I want to say is that before the call, you told me that there are some of the bigger gurus out there coming to you because they realize they need your systems in place because they don't have a business. They have, they're making a lot of money. And we started with this today. They're just making a lot
that's
of money.
That's exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so we're now our financial organization, our CFO, has created a service where we actually take successful businesses that are already successful, and in this case, you know, our first client is already a seven-figure marketer, and he wants our strategies because he wants to double his business this year, and he realizes that he needs the systems in place. So we're indoctrinating all of his staff and helping him implement all of our financial systems into his organization so that he can, you know, he doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. He's going to use something that works already.
Right, right. Well, I was in the audience when you did this at Earn 1K a Day, and this for me was worth its weight in gold because it was so succinct. I knew these things, but you put it down on paper so that anyone could understand, and I really appreciate you doing that. And the last thing I'll say about that is that when I know that my business is working, I'm following this process. When my business is not working, I go back to this and look at it because I have not been following it. So, you know, Will,
that's exactly right.
Thank you again for being here. I really appreciate it. People can find you, tell us how they can contact you, or find out what's going on in your business.
Gosh, If you want direct access to me, if I gave you my personal contact information, you wouldn't get as great of an access to me as if you actually went through our support. I'm not very good with emails. I don't really do a whole lot of direct messaging on Facebook. If you ever need anything from me or need to get a hold of me, just write to support@rapidcrush.com and ask them to forward it to me or escalate something to me, and our support staff will do a tremendous job of making sure that they get my attention and that you get a personal reply from me. So support@rapidcrush.com.
There you go. Thank you again, Will. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, David.
Thanks. Okay, so folks, we will come back in 2 hours, and we're going to work on a checklist and a plan for you to create create your own business structure and some of the things that you're going to need to do. And we're going to take a lot of this information that we got today and actually systematize it ourselves. So look forward to seeing you back here in 2 hours, 2 o'clock. Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.